Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by the OU Israel Center in Jerusalem. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is a little unusual. It's for Shabbat Parsha Toledot, but it is being broadcast live from the lobby of the Jerusalem Renaissance Hotel. Some people remember it as the Ramada. Now it's called the Renaissance Jerusalem Hotel. And it is taking place during the OU convention, their national convention that takes place every 2 years in Mirtz Hashem here in Yerushalayim. Before we get into the regular part of the show, I'd like to introduce a special guest, Rabbi Herschel Schachter, who is well known in New York, in Israel, and all over the world, I would guess. And just, Rabbi Schachter, tell us why you're here, what's the convention, especially from your perspective.
I'm connected with the OU. I come to the Kashrus division once a week to work on the Kashrus issues. I'm visiting there every week about 20 years already, and I thought that we would have solved all the Kashrus issues by now. But surprisingly enough, every week some new shailas come up, which were never discussed before in the halachic literature. In the classical tshuvas, they don't have any discussions on these, and there's still much work to be done. So because of my connection with the OU, that's why I'm here.
How about an example of something, what they say in Hebrew, picante, a nice, interesting thing for listeners, maybe a behind-the-scenes kashrut issue that we never find out about unless we have a chance to hear it straight from you.
Now I'm a little bit tired.
I mean, like something that no one would think there's a problem, but there really is, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, just generally speaking, years ago, let's say if there would be an orange juice company, so all they would process would be orange juice. Tomato juice, they would have a factory where they'd only process tomato juice. So if you buy orange juice, you know that how not kosher could it be. And now it happens that for the last 10 years or so, it's not the case. Now they have... They try to have all the factories run 24/7, and they make the machinery that it should be compatible with all kinds of things. So you can have the same factory, the same machinery will process milk and chazashmalz and orange juice and tomato juice and all kinds of things. In fact, one of the rabbanim from the OU was traveling around on vacation in upstate New York, and he saw there was a food processing factory, so he stopped in. And he said he's in the food industry also, it has to do with kashrus, and he wanted a tour. And it turned out that they processed water there, and the water was straight.
Wow.
They sold water, the water was straight, because the water was processed on the same machine that they just did clam juice, or some other kind of tray for juice. And the cleanup process did not correspond to the laws of kashrus. So that's pretty rare that the water is straight.
But that's very important for for consumers to know why even water needs a hashkacha.
Right, because the kelim are trade, because the machinery was not kosher. Years ago, it never would happen like that. Tomato juice, what could be wrong? But now, because they process, they make the machinery in such a way that it's compatible for different foods. So, that's not a shadow that they need meat for. That just happens to be a fact.
No, that's a good example. Let me just explain that this show is the Torah Tidbits Audio, based on the Torah Tidbits, which is our weekly Torah publication. So any question in the realm of Torah belongs on this show. With that introduction, I just forgot what I wanted you to mention, but if you could give us maybe a little tiny insight into Yaakov and Esav, and how the fact that two twins can turn out so different, and what message that might have for us.
Twins very often turn out to be very different. I don't see that it's a problem at all. According to the halacha said that only from the days of Yaakov Avinu were all the children considered Jewish. That's called mitos or shlema, that all the children are Jewish. Avram Avinu had several children. Only one was Jewish, the others were not. Yaakov had two, Yitzchak had two twin sons. One was Jewish, the other one was not Jewish.
No, when we quote from the Torah about God promising Avraham and his descendants throughout the generations, Arabs somehow or Muslims grab on to Yishmael,
right?
And I don't
know. The Arabs
who...
are the biological, they may be the biological descendants of Avraham Avinu, but they're not called the Zera Avraham. There's a concept of Zera and a concept of Bain. Tosfos in Yevamos points out that in biblical Hebrew they have two different connotations. The word Bain means a child, whether the child follows in the footsteps of the father or not. The word Bain only means a son. It doesn't necessarily include the grandchildren and further descendants, as opposed to the word Zera. The word Zera only applies, the word Zera is like a seed. If you take a seed from an apple, you plant the tree, you're going to get apples, you're not going to get pears. The word Zera only applies, even applies to future generations. And the word Zera only applies when the offspring follow in the footsteps of the original ancestor. Eretz is always promised to the Zera Avram. Zera Avram are the Jewish people.
Okay.
Yitzchak Yikor Lecha Zera. Yitzchak and he and Yaakov were the Zera Avram. The others are Bonim, but they're not Zera.
Okay. Rabbi Herschel Schechter, thank you very much. Okay. Torah Tidbits Audio. Let us begin the regular part of the show with the chapter of Tehillim, which we always say, Perek Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir hama'alot mima'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli, tihiena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Imavonot tishmorya Adonai mi ya'amod. Ki imacha haslicha l'ma'an tivare. Ki viti Adonai kivata nafshi v'lidvaro ho'cholti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim l'boker, shomerim l'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut, v'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. That was Achinu Beit Yisrael, but let's say it the way we usually do. Achinu Kol Beit Yisrael, Hanatunim Batzara Uvashivya, Ha'omedim Bein Bayam Uvein Bayabasha, Hamakom Yerachem Aleihem, V'yotzieim Mitzara Lirvacha, Umeafela Laora, Umishibud Lugula, Hashtaba Agala Uvizman Kariv, V'nomar Amen. You know, this OU convention brings together a lot of people from the States who came here. Some of them came early, and they had a two-day learning program called Yarche Kala. Then the convention started last night. They'll be here through Sunday. And there's a lot of intermixing of former Americans who live in Israel with the Americans who come. And you get a sense, a little bit more than usual, of Achinu Kol Beit Yisrael, our brothers, all the house of Israel. And this particular passage, which the music focused on and which I just recited, speaks of Jews, Hanetunim Batzara Uvashivya, Jews that are in trouble and in difficult situations, whether they are at sea or on land, which is a euphemism for anywhere that they are. And we ask Hamakom, another name for God, Hamakom Yerachem Aleihem, should have mercy on them, V'yotzieim Mitzara Lirvacha, from the narrow places to the more expansive place, Me'afela Le'ora, from darkness to light, Mishibud, from slavery and oppressive conditions, to Geula, redemption and freedom, Hashta Ba'agala, Uvizman Kariv V'nomar Amen. Now, as soon as possible, and we say Amen. This refers to the obvious examples, and it refers to the subtle examples. Obvious examples would be the Israeli soldiers that were kidnapped and still are found in captivity. The obvious example would be a Jonathan Pollard, who still is languishing in prison in the United States, even though everybody agrees he should have been released a long time ago. You have to put an asterisk next to everybody, because obviously not everybody agrees. But it also goes to Jews in poverty and Jews in difficult conditions and people all over who have troubles. And it behooves us to pray on their behalf that God takes mercy and takes them out from the bad times to the good times. I've seen, actually I've done it myself, a preface to Achinu Kol Beit Yisrael, which is a beautiful statement that a person should accept upon himself the mitzvah in the Torah of V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, to love his fellow as himself. This is something which is sort of a little unusual. In other words, the hineni muchan mezuman, here I am ready to perform a mitzvah, usually goes for things like the counting of the omer, the waving of the lulav and etrog, many things at the Seder table. So we look to a mitzvah and we say, here I am about to perform a mitzvah, and I am making this introductory statement that I'm getting ready to perform the mitzvah, and then I make a bracha, and then I do the mitzvah. But then you have something like, V'yahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your fellow as yourself. That is a mitzvah, no less than to eat matzah at the Seder or to count the Omer for the 7 weeks between Pesach and Shavuot. And yet people don't think of it that way. And this, Hareini Mekabel Alai, here I hereby accept upon myself the mitzvah of V'yahavta l'reacha kamocha, allows you to refocus on a mitzvah, a very important mitzvah, a, let's call it, the foundation of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, the mitzvot that relate, of which there are many, between man and his fellow. And man here is the generic term. It's men and women and their fellows. And that's what Achinu conveys also. So if you stand in prayer and you say, for example, Psalm 130, and you ask God to help you out of difficult times, saying Achinu when you finish that plugs you in and say, God, I'm not just asking for myself, but I'm asking for all of Klal Yisrael, Jewish people anywhere they are in the world. And I would even go one step further, and even though that prayer was specifically for the Jewish people, we are concerned not only with Achinu Kol Beit Yisrael, but with Achinu or Bnei Dodenu, the people of the world, wherever they have difficulties, God should help them out. Okay. Parshat Toledot. Sort of an in-between kind of thing. I don't know if this is the fairest way to describe Yitzchak, but certainly when we speak of the forefathers, which I remember as a kid confusing me, and I've seen it confuse others, because when you ask how many forefathers there are, the answer is three. And unless you see it in writing, F-O-R-E, you're not really aware of the fact that it's not the number four. But anyway, that's a joke you could pick on. You could try it on your children or grandchildren. When we speak of the forefathers, we speak of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. If you look at the textual material in the book of Bereshit, you will find, I would say, more on Avraham Avinu, more on Yaakov Avinu, and less on Yitzchak. And among that text about Yitzchak, you have a lot of things which seem to duplicate that which Avraham did. He goes down, or he wants to go down to Egypt for a famine, as his father had, but God stops him and says, you're not allowed to leave the land, which is an interesting point also. I'll get back to that in a moment. But you have Avraham digging wells for water. Yitzchak redigs the wells that his father had dug. And the Torah makes a point of telling us that he wasn't just digging wells for water. He was redigging the ones that had been done in the time of his father Avraham. And you have an interaction with Avimelech, probably not the same Avimelech. Avimelech is the general term for the king of the Plishtim. But Avraham was involved in him, and Yitzchak was also. So less text, less original kind of stories. And the major story of Yitzchak is the Yaakov and Esav part of it, which involves Yitzchak, but it already is the passing of the baton to the next generation. However, Yitzchak is a very significant and important patriarch for us, specifically because he is in between Avraham and Yaakov. And again, I know that this will people will react some to say you're not giving Yitzchak the fair shake, and maybe I don't know enough how to explain the unique nature of Yitzchak. He's certainly different, even on what I just said before about his not leaving Eretz Yisrael. Avraham Avinu was born to idol worshippers, grew up and as a child that way, came to a belief in God, according to some opinions, at the age of 48, and then rediscovered belief in God. Yitzchak Avinu didn't discover belief in God. Yitzchak Avinu was raised by Avraham and Sarah, and he was imbued from the cradle with belief in God in a very, very special way. He was the one that rose to a level of kedusha, of sanctity, where God says to him, a person on your level cannot leave Eretz Yisrael. And this was the land of Israel before it was the land of Israel. I really shouldn't put it like that because it's always the land of Israel, even if it's called Canaan in the Torah. But you know what I mean. Until Yehoshua, Joshua, brings the Jewish people into the land of Israel and they fight for it and settle it, conquer and settle, and then it becomes the Eretz Israel of the Jewish people. Here it is the potential. Although the Torah repeats that God is giving this to Avraham and his descendants, not just to the descendants. So it already belongs to Avraham Avinu. It belongs to Yitzchak, and not, by the way, to Yishmael, although Avraham had two children that are significant in this respect. The Torah makes a point of saying, Ki v'yitzchak yikarei l'chazara, like you heard Rabbi Schechter mention before, it is the descent of Avraham is defined as Yitzchak and his descendants, and that gets further refined when it does not include the descent of Esav, but only of Yaakov. But getting back to Yitzchak himself, we have Yitzchak as the important link. I wrote a piece in Torah Tidbits this week that made the statement, I sort of made it up myself, that it isn't a chain until at least it has its second link. A first link is a ring. By itself, it doesn't go any place. You attach another ring to it, you already have the beginning of a long chain. And another ring, and that includes all the way down to our own lives and our own times. We are chains in the link. We're links in the chain of tradition. And that tradition starts, in one respect, with Avraham Avinu, through Yitzchak, through Yaakov, through the tribes, and through all the generations of Jews, till this day and onward forever and ever. But again, I say Yitzchak is the anchor, the stable focus on strengthening that which started as a discovery of Avraham. And here's where you know that the seeds that Avraham planted take firm root in the form of Yitzchak and are capable of reproducing and continuing through to Yaakov and through Yaakov to all of the Jewish people. The Torah in this parsha starts by telling us of Rivka's pregnancy. Let's go back one step. You have a progression where things are getting tighter and tighter. Avraham had a brother, Nachor, and they each had their wives, and they each had children, and Avraham had Yishmael, in addition to Yitzchak, Yishmael first, but not from Sarah. Same father, different mothers. And then Rivka, in the beginning of our Sedra, is pregnant with twins. She is very worried about it because of the turmoil she feels inside her. And she goes to consult a prophet of God who tells her you have two future nations that will come from you, and they will always be in conflict, and that's problematic. In fact, that defines Jewish history. With Torah Tidbits Audio. I have a special guest here. I'll introduce him in a moment. I just want to say first that this is always really a joint broadcast of both Israel National Radio and OU Radio. This one more so because the shows will be identical. It won't be up on the OU Radio website until tomorrow morning sometime, New York time, because of their Thanksgiving vacation. But it's now you're listening live or archived, as the case may be. My guest is an old friend and a member of the board of directors of the Orthodox Union, Avery Newmark from good old New York City. And basically, I'd like to say hello, welcome to Israel, and tell us a little bit about why you took time from your busy schedule to be here at the convention.
Well, good to see you again, Phil, and to everybody here. Happy Thanksgiving. Even though we're in Israel, we still feel the Thanksgiving of the United States, because indeed Thanksgiving's a holiday for all Americans wherever they are throughout the world. And here at the convention, we're just about to start our gala Thanksgiving dinner. So we're celebrating here. We know in New York it's raining, but the parade is going on. We came to Israel. I came actually with my son Jacob to visit our daughter, Elise, who's learning this year at the Midrash at Lindenbaum. But we combined the trip with the OU convention, and we felt this is the best time to come. First of all, we hadn't seen our daughter in a long time, since August, almost 3 months. But also it was important to attend the OU convention, and with the holiday weekend, we felt that this is a good time to spend in Israel while not losing so much time at work in New York. The OU convention.
Let me bring up an old topic. Everybody knows the OU Kashrut symbol. We at the Israel Center have this all the time. When somebody sees OU, they look around looking for the Kashrut operation, which happens to be in a small office on our third floor at the center. We know that in the States it's a much, much bigger operation. I'm more interested in listeners finding out what else the OU means.
The OU means much, much more than just kashrus. When I grew up and when I was with you, Phil, in the States, of course, the main part of the OU was NCSY, the National Synagogue, National Conference of Synagogue Youth. We used to travel around the country identifying young Jewish people who were lost and that needed help. We taught them what Shabbos was. We taught them what Kashrut was. We had them come to local synagogues and local areas for Shabbatonim, for activities, for concerts. Phil, you and I went from New York to Detroit to Cincinnati to Miami to the West Coast. And what NCSY is throughout the United States, throughout Canada, is something much, much, much more important than a lot of other work that the OU does.
One of the things I hope you find out about when you're here is how we've taken the model of NCSY to spread it and make it truly international. You know, we have this strange name for the Israel Center, which is the Jerusalem World Center. So people hear that, they see that, and they really get a little confused because world seems to be much bigger than Jerusalem. And yet you have an international sense. We have reshaped NCSY here in Israel to work with Israeli kids, and we do a lot of work with Israeli youth, teens, young adults, and adults that are unaffiliated, and basically try to continue the model as set by the Home Office.
As a matter of fact, last night at the opening dinner of the convention, that was a theme that the president, the reelected president Steve Savitsky, emphasized. He emphasized that the point here is now to bring people who are already Jewish, obviously, and already in a Jewish environment, but to understand their Jewish heritage, to understand the Torah, to understand mitzvot. And this is one of the main activities of the center and one of the main emphasis of the OU here in Israel now. And not only did Steve Savitsky mention it, but one of the chief rabbis also mentioned this in his address last night.
Very good. What else does the convention have a specific, this might have been asked on previous shows, does the convention have a specific goal? Are there resolutions that we should know about that are going to be discussed and decided upon?
The resolutions are going to be discussed on Motzai Shabbat, and to be perfectly honest, I haven't reviewed them all, but the basic goal of the convention is the reason why the convention's here. That's where there's a lot of discussion. Should there be? We're an American organization. And again, the convention is here like it was 2 years ago. And the feeling was the tie between the United States and Israel to strengthen Israel and to show our support and our chizuk for Israel was very important. And that's why we're having the convention here.
How does the OU get involved in encouragement of Aliyah, per se, or just support of Israel?
100% Aliyah, 100% of 100% support of moving to Israel, living in Israel. We've had projects with the Gush Katif. We've had projects in the north. When the summer had the tragedy in the summer, the war in Lebanon. So the OU is all over Israel and playing a major part in Israel as well.
Avery Newmark, member of the board of directors of the Orthodox Union and good old friend, thank you very much. Very nice to see you.
Phil,
and
good
enjoy
to
the
be
rest
here
of the
again.
Convention.
Thank you.
Back to Toledot. Before that, we just started the month of Kislev. There's an interesting side point that I wanted to share with you, and it's not the same all over the world. The Molad, the birth of the new moon of this month, was this past Monday at about 8:45 Israeli time, Israel time. The first opportunity to say Kiddush Levana is 3 days after the Molad. That would be, if you count with me, to Tuesday, to Wednesday, to Thursday at 8:45 in the evening. Has to be 3 full days after the Molad. So we should be able to say Kiddush Levana tonight, sometime after 8:45. The problem is that the moon will have set at 6:30. Still up now, close to the horizon. In less than an hour, the moon will be gone. So by the time 8:44 rolls around, there is no moon, and therefore you cannot say Kiddush Levana. Next opportunity will be tomorrow night. Tomorrow night is Leil Shabbat. The custom is not to say Kiddush Levana on Shabbat or Yom Tov, unless it is the very last opportunity, and it would mean not saying Kiddush Levana unless you do it on a Friday night. So we're not going to say it Friday night either. The next and very good opportunity is this coming Motzoi Shabbat, and it is a prime time, a Motzoi Shabbat, with people still in the Shabbat atmosphere, perfumed, as the expression is, from Shabbat, are able to properly greet the divine presence with the bracha and other passages of Kiddush Levana. That's the story. However, if you live in a place that has a different time zone, let's see if I could work this out. At 8:44 on Thursday night, the moon has already set for us in Israel. It is only 1:44 in the afternoon, let's say in New York. By the time Thursday night rolls around in New York, it is after 3 full days following the Molad, and therefore Jews in New York, the East Coast, and many other places, probably all over the United States, will be able to say Kiddush Levana as early as Thursday night. Many of them will wait for Motzoi Shabbat anyway, because that's a very popular time for Kiddush Levana. But just to understand the technicalities, we in Israel are not allowed to say Kiddush Levana this evening when we see the moon. Jews who are in the time zones that allow them to see the moon after sunset, when it's already past 3 full days since the Molad, will be able to jump the gun on us and say Kiddush Levana a couple of days before we will be able to. Back to Toledot. I mentioned earlier that after the famous business with the birth of Yitzchak and Esav and the definitions and descriptions of the character of Esav and the character of Yaakov, and that Yitzchak loved Esav and Rivka loved Yaakov, I wanted to share with you an idea that was expressed by Rabbi Yosef Wolicki, one of the teachers at the Israel Center, and I think it's a very novel approach. There's always this question as to whether Yitzchak knew really the kind of person that Esav was, or was, quote, blind to it. And I think it cannot escape our notice that the Torah describes Yitzchak as being physically blind, and it raises the question whether he was also blinded in a figurative sense towards a basically wicked person that Esav was. And there are commentaries who say that Yitzchak was not aware, really, of Esav's character, that Esav would ask him certain questions and feign interest in certain things to give his father the impression that he would be a faithful follower in the Avraham tradition. But others say he knew very well what Yitzchak was, what Esav was, that Yitzchak knew very well what Esav was, but felt that loving him and favoring him would be able to straighten him out. This is especially poignant in light of the fact that Yitzchak realized, again, this is speculation, and I'm quoting Rabbi Wolicki, that Yitzchak realized that he was the cause of his half-brother Yishmael's banishment from the house of Avraham. Sarah Imenu told Avraham to get rid of Yishmael and his mother, Hagar. Avraham hesitated doing that. God said to Avraham, listen to Sarah, And as a result, Hagar and Yishmael were banished from the house because the main target of their education was to be Yitzchak Avinu. However, might it be that Yitzchak felt bad about that, felt bad that he was the cause of the banishment of his half-brother, and made a very conscientious attempt during his lifetime not to let that happen to Esav. Here he sees in his own two children, albeit different because both were twins from Rivka, as opposed to Yishmael being from Hagar, a different mother, not from Sarah. But still, he sees a Yaakov and an Esav. He sees that a Yaakov Avinu is the one destined to follow in his footsteps, and he has no problems with Yaakov. His problem child, so to speak, is Esav, and he wants to devote energy to maybe bring Esav back to a good path, especially because he did not want to see what happened with Yishmael happen to his own son, Esav. In any event, Esav, as wicked as he is portrayed in descriptions of his character, has one very, very favorable review, and that is his extreme honor of his father. And to the point, I mean, you could almost feel a little sympathy for him when the Torah tells us that when he perceived that his father and mother disapproved of the wives that he had married till that point and were sending Yaakov away back to Rivka's hometown to find a suitable bride, he went ahead and married someone new, held her above the rest of his wives, and it was just not an appropriate choice again. But he tried. He seems to try to please his parents. Even the fact that he married first at the age of 40, as Yitzchak did, commentaries mention, in his favor of, subconsciously at least, trying to be like his father. Be that as it may, I want to introduce an idea. We've spoken about it in the past, and that is the portrayal of Esav in our traditional sources that go beyond what the wording in the Torah itself seems to say. Let's put it like this. The Torah tells us at the beginning of Parsha Toledot that Esav came in from the field and he was exhausted. Vayavo Esav min hasadeh v'hu ayef. He's tired. And the Gemara on that spot says, don't think the word sadeh just means a field. Don't think the word ayef just means physically tired. Both of those words and others in these verses indicate that on that very same day, the day of the death of Avraham Avinu, Esav committed some very, very serious sins. We don't have to go into the details, but the words are the tip-off of ayef and sadeh. The question can be asked, why can't sadeh mean field, and that's all? Why can't ayef mean tired, and that's all? He was tired, he came from the field, and he goes to his brother who's cooking this porridge of red lentils, and he says, give me some, I'm hungry, I'm tired. Why do our sages teach us a very much darker, more sinister meaning to those words which seem to just be a routine kind of story? Part of the answer, an important part of the answer as far as I'm concerned, is that we are not speaking of a hatchet job performed by our sages on Uncle Esav to cast him in a bad light. We are talking about tradition, a tradition which is part of oral Torah, passed down through the generations, that say that Esav was an evil person. that Esav instigated his grandson Amalek, which became synonymous with anti-Semitism, and would say, look, I wasn't able to vanquish Yaakov. I want you to continue my job with his offspring. And that became a charge throughout the generations to set up a an attempt to destroy the Jewish people. That was Esav. It's not Chazal, our sages, looking into the word Oyef, doing some research and saying, oh, wait a minute, I got it. Here is a negative definition or connotation of Oyef. Let's stick it on to the story with Esav. No. Esav was an evil, wicked, bad person. That he was is clued through certain wordplay and other things that the Torah tells us, but it by no means is a creation of a PR for the Jewish people who wanted Esav to look bad. I had a friend in school that every time we got to this weekly portion of Toledot, he felt bad for Esav because he felt he was getting the short end of the stick. And he can pull a certain sympathy because you have the issue of the deal that Yaakov made for the birthright and the deal that Yaakov made taking away the blessing. And one might think that, you know, poor guy, he's really pathetic. He's such a strong guy, and he cries when he finds out that his father gave his blessing to his brother. We have to believe and understand that that blessing was meant to go to Yaakov, and it was meant to be offered to Esav, but taken away from him on purpose. Some of this I don't understand and I can't explain, but what I have a very, very strong feeling about, which is what I'm trying to convey, and I don't know if it's getting across, is that Esav was who he was. When Rashi tells us, halacha biyadua, it is a well-known fact of life. She'esav sone liyakov, we do get a glimpse of that in this week's Parsha of Toledot, when we have the description of Esav hating Yaakov and saying in his heart that he was going to kill him after Yitzchak would pass away. That again reflects on his high regard he had for his father and his relationship with his father. But nonetheless, this is what our tradition, which is a combination of the written law and oral teachings that are passed down from generation to generation, come to tell us about it. So that's the story. In other words, just like you have tradition that impacts on halacha, Jewish law, you have traditions that impact greatly on the traditions that we have about biblical personalities and about episodes that happen in the Torah. And of course, one is entitled to ask the question, why does the Torah use certain language and then require an oral Torah explanation to say, oh, that's what it means? This is a whole topic. We've touched upon it in different shows, but it is a very important concept in Judaism that the written word is not the whole picture. In fact, the world attempted to take the Torah from the Jewish people. They grabbed on to the written word. They required us to translate it into their language, and from there translate it into many, many other languages. And they said, ah, now we have the Torah. The answer is they don't have the Torah. The non-Jewish world, and much of the Jewish world, sadly, does not possess the Torah. They have the written portion of the Torah, which is open to widespread misreading and perversion and distortion without the Torah tradition as passed down from generation to generation and as embodied in the oral law and the oral tradition and Talmud and other works of that type. That's the short end of it. That's really all the time we have for it. The convention is kind of revving up here. It's a little hectic in the lobby. I always marveled in the two times that I've broadcast from this room how things could go on all over the place, and somehow the show goes on. I've got a set of earphones which are not so much important for me to hear this music that you're listening to, but it blocks out the sound of other people, and as you hear from that music, that's about it. So I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, a Chodesh Tov, and Lehishtameah.